the Fucking Normal podcast. I'm your host, Rena.
I'm Lauren.
And on today's episode, we'll be talking about a subject that is the Fucking Normal's raison d'etre, coping through connecting with others and building community. It was back in episode one of the podcast that we talked about loneliness and why finding others that get it was so important for us. It really is one of the best things you can do when you start down this less typical parenting path. It doesn't have to be face-to-face or a proactive and specific diagnosis-related group, which can seem daunting in those early days, but even something more passive like a book, film, or a podcast. When you are struggling, there is such comfort in realizing you're not alone. Hopefully those listening are finding out that there are so many cool families out there, similar to you, people that you would hang out with anyway, that are doing disability their own way, that can share their war stories and their moments of joy, their wisdom and collective parenting knowledge to help you along the way.
And our guest today is Australian author and journalist Melanie Dimmitt, who has done so much to build communities in the disabled parenting space. Mel, who is mum to 7-year-old Arlo, who has cerebral palsy, and Odie, who is 5, and as Mel puts it, medically boring. I love that. When Arlo was diagnosed, Mel coped by connecting with others in a big way, using her journalistic skills to interview and write about others who had trodden this path. And so her debut book was born, Special, The Antidotes to the Obsessions That Come with a Child's Disability. Candid, validating, and really fucking useful. It is something I'd recommend to any parent to a disabled child, particularly at the beginning of their journey. Since Special, Mel has continued to do so much in the space, and amongst her achievements are an award-winning podcast helping parents to navigate the Australian Disability Benefit System, NDIS. And last year, as Arlo had recently started tube feeding, what did she do? She went and launched a magazine, The Blend, an annual lifestyle magazine designed to inform and inspire the tube feeding community. Absolutely amazing. So, so happy to have you on the podcast, Mel.
Welcome.
Thank you both so much for having me. I feel right at home being on a podcast that has fuck in the title. I'm just warm embrace. You're my people.
You knew it. I think I knew it like the first paragraph or so of your book. And I was like, yes, she is my type of person.
Pretty early on, first page, I'm sure. Yeah. And there are many pages within, again and again.
Well, if you can't, I mean, you know, each to their own, but if you can't swear and laugh and rant, then, you know.
What's the point?
Yeah, exactly. You're making disabled parenting way harder than it needs to be.
Exactly.
So I guess, could you start, Mel, and, you know, maybe I'll just mention as well that Mel and I actually know each other through a mutual friend from the days when Mel lived in London. So it's like amazing to be kind of connecting again after all of this time. And I'd really like to hear just how you're doing now and how, and know a bit more about Arlo and kind of your family setup and what are things like?
Yes, Lauren, so awesome to reconnect, like you say, and we knew each other, it feels like a million years ago, through a mutual friend who was my housemate. Hi, Vix, if you're listening, really miss you. We're good. Arlo's still up, so we could be better, and I'm sorry if you hear noise in the background. It's night over here. We're good. Everyone's relatively healthy. We're very busy. My partner, Ro, and I both work pretty much full time. He's in the media too. He's a newspaper editor and I write, and we both do it from home, work remotely most of the time. So we're here with our kids pretty much all the time with zero boundaries, and it's really fucking stressful, but amazingly flexible. You know, we got a call from Arlo's school today saying he's not quite right, and we were there within, you know, 10 minutes. So it's beautifully flexible. I think it suits our lifestyle really well. We can drop everything and head into hospital or do whatever we need to do. I'm making it sound like our life is a disaster. We've had a pretty good run of no hospital for a while now. But yeah, I'd say we're having a good patch. Arlo is loving school. He's in just the local public mainstream school in year one. This year he's got full-time one-on-one aid with him the whole time, which is wonderful. He adores school. He's always been a really, you know, social little guy. And his sister Odie joined him this year. So it is so cool, like dropping them off. You know, we get to go into the rock star, amazing disabled parking area now with our brand new van that we just got that has this incredible ramp that just automatically slides out. And it's like this red carpet rolls out and Arlo comes down and Odie insists on walking down the ramp as well, and they hell walk into theater, and it's so cool. And it's just, you know, now that they're both at school, I really feel like we're in a bit of a, I don't want to say easier because I'll, you know, it, I'll jinx it.
Yeah,
it's got different challenges, but it's definitely simplified things, them being in the same place at the same time most days when we don't have sickness. So I know things are good. I'd like a bit more calm. We definitely work too much and we need more holidays and more date nights. We have zero at the moment, but generally we're pretty happy. We're laughing every day, which is good.
Oh, lovely.
That's beautiful. And not to kind of jump from that beautiful, positive image of now, but can we now rewind to back how things were at the very start and how you know, Arlo's diagnosis and how you coped with that? And I guess how you decided to go and write Special. Because I have to say, I'm so impressed that you're kind of, what appears to be your way of coping with things is to like, use your tools to go and create something. It's amazing. But honestly, tell us at the start.
So look, back when Ali was diagnosed with cerebral palsy at 6 months, if you'd have told me what my life would look like now, that I'd be talking about ramps coming out of cars and wheelchairs. And so Ali's got quite profound cerebral palsy. He's level 5 on the GMFC. I always say this wrong, but that scale. So physically he's quite impacted, so he needs to be in a wheelchair all the time. He can take steps in his walker, which is really cool when he's in the mood, which he's not always. He's also non-speaking, so he communicates a hell of a lot through his eyes, expressions, the gorgeous sounds he makes. And he also uses this incredible AAC device where he's talking with his pupils, which just blows my mind. But if you told me any of that back when he was diagnosed at 6 months old, I would have died. I wouldn't have coped with it. When we got his diagnosis, I did not handle that information very well. I didn't know what cerebral palsy was. We were warned. He had a really shitty birth. My pregnancy was pretty normal. I think we were 4 days past our due date. And I could feel that he wasn't moving around as much. And I'm guessing it's the same there. They say, you know, if your baby feels weird, go into the hospital. So we did, and they checked him out and they said, oh no, he looks all right, go home. And we were driving back and I was like, no, it definitely feels wrong. Went back again. They kept me in overnight, kept checking on him, and he seemed okay, but they said, look, we'll induce you in the morning. And that next morning they had me all hooked up to the fetal heart monitor, and we were just about to be induced, and out of nowhere his heart rate just dropped dramatically. And then it was button pressed, emergency Caesar called for, me under within what it felt like 10 seconds, and me just watching my partner Rose's face sort of disappear down the hall as I was being taken off to theatre and being put under. So it was a very dramatic entrance. And I woke up in the NICU. They placed gorgeous Arlo on my shoulder. He looked straight into my eyes and it was just love. And I was like, this is fine. He's alive. We're all good. Mm-hmm. He was in NICU for a week. They did a scan of his brain and it showed there was bilateral damage to the motor section of his brain. And they said, look, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. They said, worst case scenario, it'll be cerebral palsy. And I just let that slide right over me. I was like, not having a bar of that. That's not going to be us. He's alive. We're fine. This will all be fine because everything is always fine. Could not cope or even think about cerebral palsy, whatever that was, as being, you know, what our life was going to be. And as the months went by, gorgeous Arlo, so smiley, so engaged, so wise, did not hit a single motor milestone. So he never rolled over, never sat up, couldn't hold his head up much. He still can't do those things. So at 6 months, we were given the diagnosis and I thought the world was over. I did not see any way that my son could be happy or have a meaningful life. I hate talking about this now because I'm like, what an idiot that girl was. But at the time I thought, this was it. And I wasn't accepting it. And I was bargaining with the universe and being like, this is okay. So long as he can walk and talk and no one can tell that he's got a disability. I'm guessing you guys might have felt something similar.
Exactly the same. It was hell on earth. And then I also feel terrible for that girl 7 years previously. Just, yeah, it hits, you hit the right spots and it's just, it's like, it's really fucking weird, but it's like being seen. And it's also so validating. Like, fuck man, I wasn't an absolute bitch, but it was totally normal to feel that way. So thank you.
Oh, that's what got...
Like, if you haven't had exposure to disability, and, you know, I guess we're all kind of a similar age, that also in our upbringing, there was probably a lot less kind of visible people with disabilities on TV or anywhere. It's just a different world that you don't understand. And, you know, the kind of views, I don't think I had an overt kind of like ableist views, but I definitely had those kind of internalized ableist views just because of the way that I'd been socialized. And you just, yeah, I think it's good to remember that in a way, though, because I think when you're up against other people now, or, you know, you get the looks or whatever, it's good to kind of remind yourself that it's only through educating yourself and being immersed in it, and your child educating you and, you know, waking up to the fact that this is not the end of the world, and that every child is just as valuable regardless of ability.
I love that Arlo's in mainstream, and I love that he has all these friends, and I love that he has a sister, because I already see how these kids get it. And I wish that I'd had more awareness of disability. I wish there'd been disabled kids in my class. I wish they'd been at uni. I wish there'd been more in my workplaces, because then I do not think I would have freaked out the way I did and thought it was the end of the world. I just would have seen it's another way of being on this earth. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a lot more interesting, and you get all the feels at both ends of the spectrum. And I certainly think we're getting a much richer life as a result. But yeah, at the time I couldn't accept it. I was so sad. I was so frightened. I would have given anything for a glimpse at the future. All I wanted was to know that he'd be walking and talking and be fine, and that this wasn't going to be the nightmare that I thought it was, the thing that came up when you Googled quadriplegic cerebral palsy. And that's when I thought, look, I need something. I really wanted quotes. I love quotes that make things, you know, like inspirational quotes that turn around your thinking. And I was like, I just need words. I need words. I was like, where am I going to get those from? And I just thought, well, look, I'm not the only person on the planet doing this. I don't want to go to those, you know, disability or special needs parent support groups. I'm not ready to, you know, admit that I am a parent who should be at one of those groups, but I am a writer. I'm a journalist. I love talking to people, interviewing people. I'll say I'm writing a book. I'll reach out, you know, to people I find in the real world or on Instagram or wherever, and interview them and say I'm writing this book. And I had no real intention of actually writing a book at the start. It was really just an excuse to talk to parents and say, help me, how did you get through these early months? Please tell me this isn't what I think it is. Please tell me your child is okay. Please tell me that there's, you know, any chance of happiness in my future. And oh my gosh, the second I started talking to these parents, I felt so good. I just felt light. I felt understood. I can feel it. I have it with you guys. Like, we don't know each other very well, but there's this instant rapport that you have with other parents who are raising kids with disabilities. And as soon as I started having these conversations, phone, at cafes, on Skype at the time, this is before Zoom, I was just like, there's something here. There's something about this connection, this community. And people were saying, you know, they're in vastly different scenarios in different countries with different kids, with all kinds of things going on, different diagnoses, some of them without diagnoses, but the same things were coming up. Mm. And I was like, these are themes, these are chapters. And a book started forming and post-its started going up on my walls. And I was like, there's something here. And it was so amazing to have a project to sort of disappear into as well.
Did you find it easier at the time to talk to parents who had a different diagnosis, or were you kind of keen to latch on to those that had the same diagnosis as Arlo?
Oh, it's an interesting question. Both. I remember talking to a mum with a kid who had a similar diagnosis to Arlo. No, and that was harder. You're right. And I remember being so disappointed that she said that her son wasn't walking. And I'd be nervous to sort of ask, like, so what's happening? What are they doing? But then I kind of got past that. It took me a while, but when I started writing special, I wasn't ready to hear that my son, I really wasn't there. Like, I probably shouldn't have written it as early as I did. I was very much writing from my wounds, not my scars, but I couldn't write that book now. I can't look at it. It's for parents at the start of this, but I think it needs to be that way So it does something. So it helps parents at the start of this. It's all well and good me saying everything's great now, but you know, how does that help someone at the start when we know it's just, there's nothing worse than what you're going through at the start of this, when you think your child isn't going to have a happy life. I don't think there's anything worse than grappling with that. So no, you're right. I did find it easier to chat with the parents who had kids with completely different things going on, but
I think we found that as well. Certainly at the start, I completely avoided. So B has 18 Q deletion syndrome. I just did not go to any of the groups online, any of the information. I looked at the case studies we were given, said, nope, we're not one of these case studies. We'll be our own case study. I think it's just, you don't want to define a set of expectations and, you know, in either direction for your child. So I found it much easier to be away from something that had a direct comparison. I know Vina was very different in her approach.
Yeah, I was on that Instagram, like Noonan syndrome UK, Noonan syndrome America, trying to find as many kids with Noonan syndrome as I could. But the thing with our diagnosis is Lua has the rarest form of Noonan syndrome. So it's incomparable. All these kids with the standard Noonan syndrome are so different, but it just did give me hope, like, oh, it's okay. She will be able to walk eventually. She might be able to talk. And so I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but I did have expectations. Well, you know, if this kid in America who's got Noonan syndrome is doing this, then you should also be able to do this. And it did take me quite a while to be like, well, actually, you're a rarer form of Noonan syndrome and it's going to take you time or a different pathway, or you might not even get there. But in the beginning, it was very much like I needed to see parents living a normal life with a child who has Noonan syndrome. So
yes, cheers to that. And thank goodness for Instagram is all I can say. I do not know how parents did this before then. And it's interesting you're talking about, again, I haven't thought about this in ages, but at the start I was like, we're going to be mild CP. And I was looking at loads of mild things. And I'm like, this is okay. We can manage this. But now I almost feel that parents who do have kids with milder things struggle more, because it's almost like when you're closer to the typical, you keep trying to get there. You keep trying to go by the milestones. And I'm like, we just had to chuck out the book. Like, Arlo's just led the way. And we've just, you know, followed his lead and just, you know, he's shown us who he's going to be and what he's going to do or whatever. Like, we had just have zero expectation, which is actually, it was lovely as well when we had our daughter, just not worrying about milestones or anything. Like, it was really nice that he set us up for parenthood like that, which I think is just a good way to approach parenthood anyway, without all these horrible milestones and expectations that we automatically have.
And the comparison.
Oh yeah, that comparison, bloody hell.
In coming back to connecting then, and the people that you connected with, was there a moment when you, because obviously you were really dealing with your own, can I say denial, or?
Yeah, big time. I loved denial. Yeah.
Denial. I was the same. So dealing with your denial in those early days, and then reaching out to people, obviously things were looking to be brighter than you'd perhaps imagined. Was there a particular interview or a particular moment where you went, aha, like you sort of flipped into that acceptance zone, if you like?
Yeah. All of them did that a little bit for me. There was a couple that really stood out. One of them was with this incredible woman called Ondine Sherman, who's an author who wrote a memoir about her experience raising her twin boys, Dov and Lev. It's called The Miracle of Love. So I'd read her memoir and that really helped me. Her boys have a genetic thing, but really similar needs to Arlo. And when I interviewed her, you know, she had two, I think, 11-year-old boys at the time, both in wheelchairs, both really profound, you know, disabilities. And she said to me, I'm living my worst nightmare and I've never been happier. And when she said that, I was like, hold, I'm even getting goosebumps now. And I put that in the book because I was just like, I knew, and I was preparing to interview her and I was like, I hope this isn't my future. I don't even know how she's coping right now. And I think when she wrote her memoir as well, it was hopeful, but there was definitely, you know, she wrote it early. But yeah, when she said that, and I could see how happy she was. She was like radiating through the Skype. And I was like, wow, there's hope here. And, you know, she was amazing for that. And another interview that really helped me was with Debbie L. Nathan, who is the inventor of the UPSI, which is, I don't know if you guys have seen it, it's this contraption where you can strap your kid onto yourself and walk around with them. So your child gets the experience of walking. And she has a son with CP, quite a bit older. And she sort of said to me, you know, people, and at the time I was obsessed with Arlo walking. I was just like, he just has to walk no matter what. We'll keep working or not. We'll be trotting him around all day, every day. And she was like, when you talk to disabled adults, they don't actually care about whether they're walking or in a wheelchair or whatever. What they care about is having a social life, is having friends, is having fun. Like, what kind of a childhood is Arlo going to have if you just have him doing physio exercises all day? What kind of a childhood is his sister going to have if she's just being carted around to therapies or watching her brother get propped up against the couch? You know, therapies are important, but Debbie made me realize it's much more important that Arlo has a sense of humor and is nice, especially as someone who's going to need help his whole life. No one's going to want to help him if he's an asshole. We need to develop social skills. We need to develop a massive social circle. And same with us, you know, we need to get out. And that really flipped my thinking. And we're lucky that Arlo is very likable, very popular. He does have loads of friends, but we're really conscious of like making sure we nurture those friendships. Have the play dates, which I'm not the hugest fan of, but we do all the, you know, the parties and the play dates and things like that because he loves it. And I now think that that's more important than his little body that was never meant to walk by itself walking.
And do you find, I mean, I'm not surprised that he's sociable and gregarious and everyone loves him because I'm sure, you know, the apple doesn't fall too far. Cheesy, cringe. but no, actually on those lines, obviously it was your craft, your trade was, you know, journalism and writing, but reaching out to people, connecting, is that something that kind of you've always been good at and came naturally to you? Because I think, you know, it's all very well us three as quite sociable, I'm assuming you're quite sociable, Mel, from our past lives, but it's all very well for us if we are naturally able to do that. But I know there must be parents that don't have that kind of, I guess, social skills or nervous about reaching out to people. And it's, I guess, what would be your advice to people who are perhaps less or more reluctant to want to connect and join communities?
That's what your podcast is for. And look, at the start of this, I wasn't ready to talk to anyone, not the groups, not interviewing people. But I just listened to stuff and I read stuff. And I think podcasts are so much easier to get into than books, especially at the start when you're so freaking tired and, you know, you can't focus on words, let alone read a book. I just think podcasts like yours are the way, like the first step where people can listen to them at any point when you're up rocking back and forth with your kid, being puked on, whatever. You can have the podcast and instantly be plugged into this community of people who get you and you can hear them saying the thoughts that you're having. So my suggestion would be like, get on the podcast and then get into the Facebook. And I mean, I'm more of an Insta gal. I find the Facebook groups can be quite negative, which has its time and place. I think it's great that there's a place for people to rant, but I found they were kind of bringing me down. Whereas Instagram, pretty pictures, cute captions and things. I was like, this is more my vibe, but I'd say link into any social network you can. And through that, I mean, like, how did you guys meet? How did that happen? Did that happen in real life or did that happen on social media?
We're on this big WhatsApp group, which was kind of some friendship groups and people who'd met through chance encounters. Some Rena went to school, her kid goes to school with another friend of ours. So it was like kind of everyone was brought together onto this WhatsApp group. And I'm not saying WhatsApp groups are brilliant, but this one was. and it was pandemic time. Yeah. I mean, during the pandemic, you didn't have face-to-face opportunities. So it became our rant rave. And I think what you say about sort of being more passively engaged with something is really important. I think almost even in social media circles, you can, you know, you can join a Facebook group without having to be like posting. You can, without being like really creepy, you can like spy on people on Instagram. It's like I definitely
lurk. Yeah, I lurk on heaps of Facebook groups big time. But I'd say as well, I feel really fortunate that we did start this journey before COVID, because a lot of the friends I did make were just through sitting in the waiting rooms at therapy centers, like waiting to go into physio or OT, and just exchanging like a tired glance with another parent sat across from you. And that glance would turn to a smile the next time, the smile would turn to a hello the next time. And then eventually you're going for coffee and then you're going for a wine. So it, in those therapy centers and being in, you know, big gyms where you can see other families doing with kids like yours, or, you know, with other things going on, doing exercises, that was a huge part of me realizing I wasn't alone in this. So, you know, you're going to get your kid into early intervention anyway. You're going to hopefully be in these communities, in these big therapy centers. And that's a lovely way to actually meet people IRL and just have friendships organically develop like the old days.
I have a few IRL startup in waiting room friendships. Yeah. And weirdly, also a friendship that started when a physio put me on a blind date with another one of their mums, which was
I've had that too.
I think, oh my god, any therapist should do that. Like, please do it, because it's really, really lovely. And you can tell, I think, when you know two people are going to get on. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's a sign of a good therapist right there, I think. Yeah, they're matchmaking. Yeah, that's a really good sign of it. Yeah,
real holistic approach there. Yeah, exactly. And tell us a bit about what you've done since Special, like in between Special and the Blend, and then we'll move on to talking a bit about your experience with the Blend.
Yeah, so after Special, I guess Special kind of got me into the disability space. And someone I interviewed in Special was a guy called Jordan O'Reilly, who was the founder of a disability support organization over here called Higher Up. And he grew up with a brother, Shane, who was a lot like Arlo. And he had this amazing new concept for disability support where it's like dating. I work for this company now. They hate when I compare them to Tinder, but it is. You set up a profile for your kid or yourself and you match with disability support workers. I don't know if you call them like care workers over there, or if they're disability
support workers. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, as a parent, I wasn't even told that support workers were a thing. I thought that we'd be looking after Arlo and the only people on the planet who knew how to meet his needs for our entire lives. I didn't realize that there were people in a profession who would be there to support your child and be as good as you, if not more, at certain things. So it was really exciting to chat with Jordan about his company and about his concept of matching families with support workers where they shared something in common, where they got along as friends, where, you know, the support worker really became part of the family. And after I wrote Special, he asked me if I'd help write his company story into a book. So I wrote a book with him, really got to know the company really well. And from there, he just kind of kept nudging me into the company. So now I work part-time for Higher Up, producing their news and features platform. So I commission writers with disability to write opinion pieces in response to the news. So you guys might have seen that Beyoncé changed a lyric in her song.
Yeah.
That was because of a piece that we commissioned, that little old Higher Up from Hannah Divini, that got picked up by Amazing. The Guardian. So we're making big waves. Yeah. So we're a tiny team, but we're doing really cool things. And I do the NDIS Know How podcast through them. So it's the National Disability Insurance Scheme we have here in Australia, which is incredible. It basically means all of Arlo's therapies, the new ramp that's coming out of our car now, his support worker, his equipment is all covered by the government, by taxpayer dollars. So we're super lucky to have that here. We're fighting to keep it. So I do a podcast where I chat with other parents and people who are on that scheme about it's great, but it's really fucking complicated. So you really have to know how to work it and make it work for your family. So I have a little podcast that's sort of decoding that scheme and helping families do it better. I guess I started working and writing in disability from a parent perspective. Obviously, I can't speak. You know, I try and I'm trying to understand it better. It's interesting working with writers with disability. Well, Hannah Divini, who wrote the article that got Beyoncé to change her lyrics, is a friend now, and I can sort of, she's really interested in Arlo and always asks about him. She's got CP as well. And I can ask her stuff. I'm like, why does Arlo get really shitty at his sister sometimes when she's like running around? I was like, is that because he's jealous? And she was like, 100%. Like she said, I still have that with my sister. 100%. He is just jealous that she can run around with ease. And having someone to, you know, be able to like try and tap into what he's feeling is just so valuable. So I'm learning so much from disabled adults you know, better ways to support Arlo. So it's been really good for me. And I never thought I'd be working in the disability sector. I went from, you know, women's magazines really into this space, but I love it. I love what I'm writing now. You know, before I was writing like, you know, 10 ways to start your morning better. And now, you know, I'm helping to publish opinions from people with disability on important topics. I'm writing about stuff I care about. So I never planned to be working in this space, but here I am, and it's been incredible.
Oh my God. It sounds incredible. I'm just in awe of you. Absolutely in awe of you.
You're a writer too.
I am. So I'm doing the 10 ways to make your week look better. So it's, yeah.
They are fun. Still do a bit of that. Don't get me wrong. But have you started, like, do you write about your experience as a disability parent?
No, but I feel like talking to you, I should start doing that. I did write a blog when Lua was born, because I was sick of people just sending me WhatsApps like, how is she? Are you okay? And I was like, just leave me the fuck alone. So I just wrote a blog instead. And I was like, if you want to know what's happening in our lives, then just read that. So I don't have to deal with the million messages that I get.
Yeah.
But then I think I just got to, I did it all the while that we were in hospital. But then once she came home and the responsibility of looking after her fell on me and her dad, it was just way too overwhelming. So I was like, I can't do this. So I stopped, but I think I should. We should get back into it.
Oh, definitely do. And it's such a great way to build awareness around what our experience is actually like.
Yeah.
So as the parents like us at the beginning can read more of this stuff and see it's okay. Like, you can do this. This life is, I mean, challenging, but still happy. So yeah, please do. We need more writing from parents like you out there.
Do it, Rina. It's amazing how many parents have a pivot. Like, I mean, it's kind of not surprising, but it's also like incredible that, you know, you in, because I guess your whole life view changes potentially in most cases, and that's going to change what you want to do with your life. And it's, and also I guess there's a lot of gaps, which kind of leads us nicely to what happened when Arlo got a new diagnosis for his tube. So can you tell us a bit about how that diagnosis came about and how you felt, and then how you ended up doing the Blend magazine,
the most random magazine in the world, a tube feeding magazine?
Anyway. I wish that I had found this, or that you had made it like maybe 3 years previously. That would have been really helpful.
Well, Arlo was still, we were still shoving food into his mouth 3 years ago when we shouldn't have been. We thought he was really good at eating and he seemed to be enjoying it. And, you know, if I'm honest, we were avoiding the inevitable. Everyone was always surprised that he didn't have a tube with his level of disability, but we were like, no, we're good at this. The speeches were all saying, yeah, it looks like he's developing a stronger chew. And kind of, anyway, when he, just before he turned five, we did a modified barium swallow x-ray, and it showed that he was aspirating on every single bite of food and sip of water that was going in there. And yeah, it was like nil by mouth. We're really lucky we didn't have to go through the NG horror.
Put the foot down
and just said, no, just get us in for the G-tube surgery. If we're doing this, we're doing this. So within 2 weeks, he went from spoon-fed to G-tube. And I don't know if it's the same there, but the second they put a kid or a person on a tube, even if you were eating regular food prior, they put you on a diet of commercial formula.
Yep.
So Arlo went from breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks to 6 bottles of a really disgusting smelling commercial formula. That was it, just like drip fed through a pump.
Yep.
And there was something about this, like there's been a lot of things, you know, Arlo doesn't talk, Arlo doesn't walk. We're okay with that. We get that. We're on board. We see that that makes sense for him. But there was something about eating that was truly fucked. Like, it, that just really hurt.
Oh my God, believe me, because I studied nutrition. So food is such a big thing for me, the family, whatever. And I, kids with Noonans always have feeding issues. So like, we knew, and she had a peg kind of from when she was 4 months old. They wouldn't let us go home without having that. So I was like, fine, but I would get her to eat. And just the milks were just disgusting. And it felt so inhuman. Like, just, it's not normal to be having basically a smoothie of vanilla smelling shite shoved down your stomach like literally 8 times a day. And it was like, I can't do this. But she was so not interested in food, and it was such a struggle mentally, and just I hated the whole concept. So I did give up. I was like, right, this is just how it's going to be, and I'm just going to have to suck it up. I tried blending, and I tried to like take some sort of onus. If I can't control that you've got a peg and that you're going to have smoothies, I may as well just make you something healthy. But then it was, she was so used to having the milks that it was such a terrible transition to get her to food. And at the same time, I was trying to orally feed her, and it was just a fucking shit show. So I stopped completely. I was like, right, that's it. Until she decided November last year that, oh, I'm ready to start eating now. Out of the blue. Like, it was just, nobody expected it. We had no clue that that was even in her mind frame of wanting to eat. She picked up the spoon, opened her mouth, and she's been eating orally ever since. So now we're in the process of removing the peg. But it's been like a, yeah.
That is an amazing story. And you were totally going in the next issue of The Blend. That's very cool. Because I think a lot of parents want to hope for the tube to come out, and they're working toward that. We're very much with this again. We've thrown out the book. We're like, no, this is clearly, once we got it right, we're like, this is actually amazing. At the start, when he was connected to a pump with these bottles, it just felt like he was dying, like we were end of life. And I think part of the problem there is that tube feeding needs a rebrand, because so often it is associated with sickness and hospital and death. And there are, you know, I now I've met so many people and families tube feeding where the tube is the reason they're healthy and having an amazing life. So my magazine was a part of, yeah, the rebrand of tube feeding for families. So you're not feeling like this is the end. And yeah, we had to be really brave and kind of go against medical advice. And I went into the Facebook groups and was like, what is going on? My kid is like, the formula was terrible. He was puking so much reflux, and then he was aspirating on the puke and reflux. So we were in hospital even more. And I'm like, apparently he was silently aspirating before. There was nothing silent about the way he was aspirating once we were on this formula. So it was such a low time. We were just like, what the fuck? Like, we can't feed our own child. And that's just such a terrifying thing. It's the basic thing you need to do as a parent. So one night I'd like put him to sleep. He had vomited to sleep, basically. He was so sick. And I was like, fuck this. And like drove to Coles, like our local supermarket, right before it closed, bought his usual breakfast, like yogurt, Wheat Bix. I was like, I'm just going to put it in his mouth in the morning. And I did. I was just like, stuff it, like, and fed him, which I'm not meant to do. He's nil by mouth. But I'm like, I have no other option. This is bullshit. This was meant to help. And it didn't. Anyway, luckily got advice from other parents, other families doing this through Facebook, who said, the formula is just not going to work for your kid if this is happening. Because I kept saying to my dietitian, what do I do? I've heard about these blended feeds. And she's like, you can't try that until you get the formula right. And the formula was never going to be right, but the medical people kept saying it had to be right. Anyway, we just blended up the stuff he was eating before, so it was thin enough to go through a syringe. We put it in way too fast the first time. It just came straight up. Then we did it slowly. And from that moment on, his color came back, his sparkle came back. He was himself, and then he just started thriving. And now he just has normal food blended up super thin with our Vitamix. He's back to breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack. He eats with his sister, usually in front of the TV, but they're together and it's lovely. She's there with her little bowl and her little table that we call Cafe Odette. It's just made eating normal again. It's not all medical. Yes, there are a heck of a lot of syringes involved, and I'm like a chemist with my little Maudlin pestle, like with his million medications. I've got it down. Like, I don't even think about it anymore. And I remember at the start, the tube feeding seemed so intimidating, even like how to clamp. And, you know, there's so many bits of kit. There's so much going on. I was like, I cannot do this. It's so overwhelming. It's so scary. It's so medical. Now we've just got it down. And it's just, again, like a normal part of life. It was a lot of mess. There's a lot of, you know, when you bang the air bubbles out of a blend, you end up with crap all over your ceiling. Like, our ceilings are terrible. A lot of learning, but we got there, and now he's never been healthier. He's, you know, he's thriving. Being able to put Panadol straight in there when he's sick, oh my gosh, like the medication side, he's hydrated. The poor kid was not getting any water. Like, we were there with his cutout cup, but it was mostly driven, you know, thickened fluids. I never want to hear the term thickened fluids again. It like triggers me. He's just getting so much water now. We keep him topped up. So it's been great. But yeah, at the start, it felt rubbish. And again, just like special, I needed to know this was going to be okay. So I interviewed families, people who achieved their professionals in the space. And I was like, why can't we have like a sexy magazine? Why can't we have, you know, like the Vogue Living for tube feeding? So I reached out to Edie Swan, who's this incredible designer I used to work at a magazine with, and was like, would you make this with me? And sent her some ideas I had for the aesthetic, and she designed it. So she's my creative director now. And the two of us are making this thing annually. And yeah, my latest cover start, another UK talent, Loretta Harms, who's the Kneel By Mouth foodie, who was this incredible person in the UK. She's a chef who's fed via her heart. She's on TPN. So she doesn't eat. She doesn't put any food in her mouth. And she's this amazing chef, sort of showing people there are many ways to do this thing. And tube feeding is not the end. And you just make it work for you. And yeah, so it's the resource I wanted when we entered this space. And my hope is to just get it into the hands of as many tube feeding families, you know, preferably before they even get the tube in, so they can see what this, you know, all the options that are available to them.
100%. And it's so difficult in the UK because it would have been 3 years ago that we would have started like the blended diet, but there is absolutely no support, and dietitians here don't like you doing it, and there's a big pushback. So if you are to do it, they kind of sign off and say that's your responsibility. If anything happens, that's on you. Don't do it. But, you know, and they give you nothing. So at the time, so 3 years ago, the space was so, there was nothing in the space. I couldn't find anything. I found like the most awkward book on Amazon that I bought, which was terrible, but it had some really nice recipes. But it was just like really depressing. And it's like, shit, man, what am I doing? I don't even know what I'm doing. And then the fact that you know that if you're making it too thin, you're cutting down the calories, which means you have to give them more, and nobody tells you any of this. So it's, yeah, I think that's why I gave up, because it was just too much. And when you're dealing with all the other medical bits, it's just way too much responsibility. So I was like, I've had enough. But if I had had your magazine, it would have been different.
And is it available in the UK? Like, is it a digital magazine or it physical?
It's free to read online, theblendmag.com. You can read it there. I'm going to get the first ones up on Amazon if you want. I didn't think people would care about it being in print, but they really like the print magazine. So you can buy it via Amazon. I'll get the second one up there as soon as I can. I do like a print run of 1,000 copies here in Australia, and it's distributed through businesses that are in the tube feeding space. This incredible accessible fashion label called Every Human send it out with every order during Feeding Tube Awareness Week. Wholesome Blends, which are these great like pantry or shelf stable pouches of real food that you can feed your kid on the go, which is amazing because you don't have to get out the freaking blender for every meal. Tubey Fun, which makes these gorgeous little like G-tube accessories and things. Do you guys know about Bluey over there?
Bluey, as in the cartoon. Yeah. I love Bluey. It's like amazing. Yeah. It's like 10 times better than Peppa Pig.
So she makes like Bluey accessories for all the tube feeding. Anyway, goes out with these incredible businesses, and I give it out to some therapy centers. So it's a limited print run, but yeah, available on Amazon and there to read for free for anyone who wants
to. We'll put the details in the show notes, because I'm sure loads of people are going to want to. I mean, I'm not a bee's not tube fed, she eats orally, but I had a look through the first copy, and it was incredible. I found it really, really, like, I feel like I learned loads and just felt like I understood so much more than, you know, I've got several friends, including Rena, whose kids were tube fed, and it's really good to kind of, I don't know, I think as a resource, not just for the parents, but for those around them, you know, for other kids to see, because I'm sure you've experienced, you know, I know certainly even my kids or my older kids asked about it, like, what are you doing? Why is the food going in there? I think just for like family, friends, anybody that's got any connection to the tube feeding community, it's a wonderful resource. And I say resource, but it's also just like lovely to look at. It's just glossy, and like, it's the sort of thing you'd want on your coffee table. Like, Yeah, that's very nice.
I hope so. Like, we need sexier resources in this space, as you guys know well. You either get a dodgy pamphlet, something that it looks like it's made for children with rainbow writing all over it, if you get anything.
Why is the paper always grey? Like, it just makes it even more depressing. I don't know if it's just me, but
I think it's the NHS. I think it's colour printing isn't exactly, you know, we're trying to save money here in the NHS. So yeah, it's black and white, grey pamphlets.
But even like, you know, the brands, like the disability brands, the people that, you know, make the equipment, and that, like, why can't it look like Nike, or why can't it look like, you know, Respite look like Airbnb? Like, why can't we have sexy branding? And certainly in Australia, like, we've got the NDIS now, there's the money there, you know, services need to be lifting their game. Why not focus on, you know, having awesome brands, and not even make it, you know, disability, just make brands that are inclusive for everyone. We don't even need like a separate sector. Why can't just everything be anyway, this is like big sky thinking or whatever, but it was just so depressing, like looking even at some of the pieces of equipment that we'd have to have in our house for Ireland, being like, that is so, like, looking at that just makes me want to die.
Yeah.
Why can't the stuff be cute? And I mean, there's been huge improvement, but still I think there's a long way to go. Like, find me an attractive stander and I would be very happy, but at the moment ours looks like Frankenstein's monster should be in it.
I know.
Feels like there could be another project there for you, Mel. Like, and you've done so much. I mean, so the aims for the blend and special and your podcast are all very similar. It's like connecting people and helping people and supporting people. What's next?
What is world next?
Domination in the disability parenting space? Are you gonna?
Oh, well, I'll keep bringing out the blend. So that's become an annual magazine, which is great because I love magazines. I really miss working in mags, and I just love putting it together and working with Edie is really fun. But I think long-term, I love the idea of starting some kind of agency where businesses in the disability space can come to us and say, we want to make a resource for our community. Well, we want it to look cool, whether it's a magazine, a book, a podcast. And me help them do that, help them with branding, connect them with cool designers, connect them, you know, with, you know, people they can consult with, adults in the disability space, make sure that they're factoring in a hell of a lot of lived experience, bringing in disabled talent into their projects when they're creating these resources. So I love the idea of, yeah, like a production company agency that makes stuff but also helps other people make beautiful resources that show the full, you know, a bigger, vaster breadth of experience within a certain space, whether it's tube feeding or a particular disability diagnosis. I just love the idea of having a lot more, you know, hopeful, really sexy looking resources out there for families like ours.
Amen.
Yeah, please do it. I'm sure there are so many parents at home listening to this or wherever they are thinking, yes, I want that. I mean, it's even, I'm just thinking, like, even for B, her AAC device, like, why do they have to have stupid voices? Like, what, you know, like, it's
why doesn't Apple stupid is not a good that. Word. I know, but like, imagine if Apple made the devices, they'd be gorgeous. I feel like the technology that we have for AAC is like 20 years ago when you compare it to a smartphone. I'm like, why is Apple not moving in on this space? Seriously, we're a huge market. It blows my mind. And of course it costs about 10 times more for this clunky piece of kit than it would for like a sleek iPhone. So there's a lot of work to be done, ladies. I'll tell you what, but your podcast, I'm like, the second I saw it, I was like, yes, because your branding is gorgeous. Your tone is fun. It's so relatable. I was kind of sad that with our recording, I didn't get to hear your jingle at the start, because like, you got that made, right? It's the coolest song.
Yeah, that's AMAC. Yeah.
Shout out.
Shout out to E for AMAC for recording that, especially for us. We do love it.
It's so cool. Just imagine a parent new to the space and you find this like bright pink fun podcast and you tune in and it's this cool song and it's you two like having fun. Like, that just would make a world of difference. So I think more podcasts like yours, more attention to brand and tone and making things fun and relatable. I think we need so much more of that.
Do you know what I would love? I'd love to have a festival where all of this stuff came together.
Like some kind of where are we doing it though? Like a Glastonbury.
Basically Glastonbury. Fucking normal Glastonbury, but
completely accessible, no mud, because it doesn't work with the wheelchair.
No mud.
The mud.
Hoists everywhere. It's just going to be all inclusive, obviously. I don't know. I just think it's and it has to be sexy and have lots of really cool bands and I mean
that's the dream.
It is the dream.
Ability Fest here, which is pretty cool. There's Dylan Alcott, so he was like a pro tennis player in Australia and like Paralympian, I think. So he has started an all-inclusive music festival in Melbourne called Ability Fest, which I haven't been, but apparently it's like fully inclusive. There's support people there to help. A lot of the bands have disability. That's really cool.
That's so it is incredible.
Fantastic.
We just need to go. Melbourne. I mean, might need to do a UK one or a European one. That sounds amazing. Oh gosh. Yeah. I have to say, talking to you, Mel, and looking at everything you've done, it's just so positive and uplifting to think that, you know, things are evolving. There are people like yourself who are trying to make things better for all of us, because they're producing stuff that's gonna, you know, make everybody feel less alone and make it feel like it's just part of life having these additional needs.
That's it. And it's just unacceptable, the resources that, like, I remember when Arlo first got his diagnosis, a social worker came out to us from the organization we were linked in with, and she gave us a DVD. And, you know, this was 6 years ago. We didn't have anything to play a DVD with. And when we finally managed to play it, it was all about families living with kids with CP. And it was so depressing. And that DVD is like the reason I wrote Special. I was like, this cannot be it. This cannot be what we're staring into the future at. This thing is like, we need a new DVD. I can't make DVDs, so I made a book. But we just need, better. We need something with hope. You know, it's something we can relate to. I was like, you can't be giving this to new families. And the other thing she did was read to us from a children's book about a little girl with curly hair whose legs and arms didn't work like the other children's legs and arms. And I was she sat there reading from this kid's book. I was like, oh, love, like, read the room. This is so patronizing. And she meant well. But this person was just going around to new families with her kid's book and her dusty DVD. And I was like, this is not good enough. And no. As parents, you know, it's like you guys saying, like, this stuff needs to exist. It's not good enough that we're sort of just left on our own with awful Google, which you just need to stay the hell away from. We need better things thrown at parents who are new to this so they don't think it's the end of the world.
I think it's what I find really frustrating with the whole world, I mean, the disabled world, is there's so much support for our children. They're thrown into like the therapies, this, the support workers, care workers, la, la, la. And the parents are just sidelined completely. And I find that it pisses me off, basically. It just really pisses me off. Like, I am also here. I also need support. I also don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And yes, of course, my child is the number one priority. I understand completely, but there needs to be more support for parents and stuff like the podcast, the books, that just to show that there are others like you that are going through something similar and you're not alone is just the cherry.
And even just fucking learn my name. I'm not being funny, but that used to like really piss me off. And maybe that's unfair because how they, you know, it's about your child when you have a therapy appointment, but just constantly like, mum, what do you think, mum? Or like, mum's gonna stand there, or mum's gonna do this. It's like, come on, just learn my name, please. Make me feel like I'm part of this too. I'm not just like,
I understand that at hospitals, because I'm like, of course they're not gonna remember every patient's name, but when your therapist is saying that, and it's like what you said before, like, you know, it's a good therapist if they, like, our ones will always ask, so how are you going? as well as Arlo. They get it. They get that the kids, you know, well-being is very connected to your well-being, and that this is a family experiencing this, and that's how it has to be looked at. And you're right. I remember that in the early days going along to therapies, I'm like, Arlo was loving it. He was living his best life, smiling away. And I was just like miserable and didn't know, you know, I was so sad. And we need support, like you say. Like once your kid's in therapy, they're good. They're having fun a lot of the time, whereas we're just off on the sideline, just dying. So you're so right. God. We need a bit of love in those, certainly in those early weeks and months. My God,
I remember the same. It was a physio appointment, and I was super depressed. I chopped off all my hair, and I was like making a statement, like I'm just not okay. And the physio was like really lovely, super, super lovely. Did the therapy, and she saw me, and she obviously saw the hair, and she was like, "You've cut off all your hair." And then she put her hand on my shoulder, and she's like, "Are you okay?" And then I just like floods of tears. And then she like put me to therapy, or whatever. But if she hadn't asked or made that kind of where she'd noticed, I mean, cutting the hair short is like a big statement, but still, she was like, "What the hell is going on? Are you okay?"
That's when you know you're onto a good one. And I find like once you find that one good therapist, that's when things start turning around. I remember we found Arlo's physio, Sarah, when he was 8 months old, and she just loved him, got him, asked me how I was, got very involved with our family, and it was like everything started turning around from that point. Because these are the first people you meet in this space. It's so important. Everything they say, you remember, and the way they make you feel, you remember. And I just we still see her now via telehealth, because we're like, we're not letting you go. She's moved to a different city, but like we will always have our Sarah, our physio, because she's just was an absolute angel from day dot and made such a difference.
So important. So nice. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to say about projects that you've got going on, Mel? Or
just that, like, he's a cool kid. Like, for anyone who's, you know, I guess if you think about quadriplegic cerebral palsy, wheelchair, non-speaking, on paper, like, it looks pretty, you know, like, scary, sad stuff. But he's just taught me you do not need to be a walking, talking body to have a happy, meaningful life. He's an incredible kid. Smart kid, really ordinary kid in a lot of ways. So I guess if anyone is grappling with, you know, a CP diagnosis, I wish I'd had that perspective, that even with us, you know, I am now like on Dean Sherman, that wonderful mother I told you about, where I'm living my worst nightmare. I was one of those parents who, you know, if I'd known I was going to have a disabled child, I would have never had children. And I hate saying that now, because I would have missed so much and it kills me. But Arlo is the light of my life. I honestly would not change him. I don't want to know Arlo without disability. And it took me, you know, years to realize that. He showed me. It just took sort of letting him teach me and show me who he is. But he's the best, and everyone who meets him just adores him. He's the most popular, incredible kid. And he, you know, we have gorgeous Odie as well, and they have a lovely relationship. So there is certainly so much happiness to be had when your family has a profoundly disabled child in it, which I thought was impossible. But yeah, like I said, we laugh most days. It's really freaking challenging. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. And there's a lot of times when it's really unfair, like when he's sick and he misses out on stuff. But I think, you know, the highs certainly balance that out, and we just get this incredible life and this incredible perspective on the world. And I get to meet parents like you, and I just have this incredible network of worldwide other parents doing this thing, and we have this instant rapport, and there's something pretty magic about that, I think.
Oh, incredible. So beautiful. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. I mean, I don't know about you, Rena, but I want to jump on a plane to Oz now and
immediately.
I need to come to you. I miss London so much. I need to come back.
Yeah, come back sometime.
So I'll come and visit you. We can hang out.
Yes.
Share a pint in real life. Yes.
In real life.
Beautiful. Can you finish then by telling us you've listened to the podcast, so you know that we always end with asking our guests for their fucking normal. So just short, snappy. What is your fucking normal, Mel?
I love how you guys say fucking. It's so much better with an accent. My fucking normal is having superhuman strength in my thumbs from shoving food through syringes. I have like Arnold Schwarzenegger thumbs. They are so strong, and it is the most, it's like the fittest part of my body is my thumbs. Completely useless unless you're pushing really thick blends through syringes. So it's just, you know, it's a skill that I've developed over the last couple of years. I'm quite proud. Super strong thumbs is my fucking normal.
I love that. Brilliant. Because I could totally understand why.
Yep.
I could never develop that. I've always developed that one with the palm of my hand. I've got the palm.
I'm like this. So they're both got, again, sorry, bad for a podcast. Both thumbs going on the syringe. You get your own, you get your groove, don't you? Whatever way it is.
Amazing. Oh, Mel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you guys. It's been really fun. Thank you so much for having me. And yes, let's definitely give away some books to your community if you're keen to do a giveaway as well. I'd love to gift a couple of copies as special.
Oh, that would be amazing. Thank you so, so much, Mel. Bye, everyone. Loud as clouds.